I'm Carrie Brett, and this is Shot at Love. On today's episode, we're joined by Cindy House, the author of Mother Noise, whose real-life story reads like a riveting novel itself. Cindy will share how her journey through the shadows led her to write her own inspiring memoir. She survived a harrowing heroin addiction, overcame personal storms such as a difficult divorce, and weathered times of despair. But most importantly, she navigated the complexities of sharing her troubled past with her son. She's a testament to the power of recovery, second chances, and sheer determination. Cindy transforms her experiences into artistry and literary success, and she'll share why we should make art out of the worst things that happen to us, and she'll encourage us to turn our life challenges into creativity, because we can all craft a new ending and create a life filled with love. Cindy House is an essayist, short story writer, artist, and regular opener for David Sedaris on his tours across the country. She studied at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago and in 2017 earned an MFA from Lesley University. She lives in New Haven, Connecticut with her son. It is my honor to welcome Cindy House to the show today. Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Carrie. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. This is a dream. This is a dream episode for me, honestly. You are so talented. I recently went to David Sedaris and I heard you read an essay. For those who don't know who David Sedaris is, he's a famous writer and Cindy opens his shows. You read an essay and it really touched my heart and I was bawling in the audience and I sent my boyfriend to run and grab your book and he signed my book and I never imagined that you'd come on my show, but you have such an incredible story about surviving hard things. And I'm so glad that you're here today. Tell us a little bit about Mother Noise and why you were inspired to write it.
I had always been a fiction writer. I went to grad school for fiction. And then while I was in school, I had this idea to write an essay about my friendship with David. They made us do a couple of projects outside our genre. And it was the first nonfiction I'd really written. And I just opened up a floodgate of all kinds of stuff that I needed to write about, I guess. I never, ever thought my first book would be a memoir. But here we are.
It's amazing that you wrote such a powerful memoir about your life. And I remember I listened to an interview that you did. The person asked you, what does it feel like to have everyone know your deepest, darkest secrets? And you had a really powerful answer. What was that?
Well, I had reached a point in my life where it was more uncomfortable to keep it hidden. And it was just more, I just felt like I wasn't living my true life. And that can get really uncomfortable after a long time. I was just very, very tired of keeping that under wraps. And the other thing was that there was, I had a son, a young son, and there was a woman in our community who had a daughter in school with my son that, and my son was friends with her. And she posted on Facebook very honestly about her recovery, and it just completely inspired me. I just was amazed by her bravery, and I ended up talking to her about it and telling her what it meant to me to see that. And later, I think my son was in maybe fourth grade, and he had conversations with this young girl whose mom was in recovery also. And the two of them, as kids, talked about what it was like to have a parent in recovery. And so I feel like in a lot of ways, this woman in my community really kickstarted my ability to be honest and to just integrate it into my life once and for all and have it be part of my story.
And it is these regular people that put up a Facebook post who profoundly change your life sometimes. Like they really are the heroes. And that's who you connect with.
And she is mentioned in the book. I had sent her the essay. I renamed her and I said I wanted to ask her permission. And she ended up sending it to her sponsor and she was crying. And it was really, it's really that kind of connection that makes it so important to be truthful or to embrace your whole story, even the hard parts.
Tell us a little bit about your background. I know you mentioned to me that you grew up in the suburbs and you grew up in a world that really didn't value your nonconformity. And it took you a long time to own who you were as a creative person. Tell us a little bit about your earlier life, because that really sets the foundation for your book.
I just didn't grow up with a lot of artists. There weren't artists in my family. And I was sort of scrambling to just find a way to be around that. I ended up finding an art high school that I went to, but I didn't find it until my junior year of high school. So I only had 1 year there, but that helped. And then I went to the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. I felt like I was sort of hiding my whole life. And I ended up with severe depression that was just not, it was unrelenting. And I tried to stumble through college. I would take time off and I ended up hospitalized. And that led eventually to an addiction, a lot of self-medicating, which eventually led to heroin. And then I really lost most of my 20s to being in and out of hospitals and very ill. That was kind of the hard part. And the thing is, in the end, I feel like the fact that I made things is part of what saved me, because when you are that deep into addiction, a lot of times making it means having something bigger than the addiction. For some people, it's getting their children back if their children were taken away. For me, it was, I really wanted to be a writer. I really wanted to survive so I could make things. And that's a lot of how I eventually got out, was that desire was big enough that I could sort of grab onto it and get well.
This period of time when you were addicted, I can remember, and I've never shared this about my cousin, but I remember going to the cardiac unit, and he was there before he died. And I remember saying to him, you can get high in other ways. Like, I have the best high of my life from shooting a cover. And I tried so many different ways to show him that there was another side to life. I'm so glad that you had something else to hold on to and that you did make it. The numbers of people who survive addiction that has such a strong hold on you, heroin, they say, I think it's the hardest thing to overcome. What do you think people might not understand about addiction?
I think there's more knowledge now and more people understand it. But I still think there's this idea that you're off having fun the whole time and that you just cannot, that you have no discipline or that it's about partying. I always used alone. I was completely alone. And part of my addiction came from not having connection, meaningful connection with other people. And I felt like at the time that heroin answered all of that for me and made me able to stay alive, because it started with such debilitating depression. I think that some people don't understand how much suffering is involved and how no one grows up and wants to be an addict. No one plans for that. It's really, really tremendous suffering. And I met some of the greatest people in my life in recovery. There are amazing people suffering. There isn't a type. These are not bad people. I think that there are still some people who think that it's just a lack of discipline or whatever, but it's really suffering. It's really an illness that you fall into.
It is all about suffering and feeling alone and feeling hopeless. I think that hopeless is a big piece of it. The connection, you write about connection, the connection with others saved you and your relationship. So you had this really tough time in your 20s where you were really struggling. And I think a lot of people struggle in their 20s. It is such a tough time of trying to find your way in general. And back then, when you were going to school, no one talked about addiction. No one talked about being alone. No one talked about mental illness. And now people are talking about it. And that brings people closer together. It gives resources. I'm not surprised that the most incredible people are in these recovery groups. It makes perfect sense to me because they almost feel things more intently than others and their heart sometimes can't take it. And they just don't have the resources sometimes. David was someone that you've said really saved your life and gave you hope. And what really helped you was every time you reached out to him, he responded back. Why is it important to have just one person believe in you?
The thing was, as I was slipping into addiction, his career was taking off. When I first knew David, he had never published anything. He hadn't been on NPR yet. And so I was kind of watching this rise while I was sinking. He just never gave up on me. Every time I reached out, he would ask to see work. He told me I was a great writer. The sky was the limit. When you're sinking into addiction, you really hate yourself. It's very difficult to climb out the more you're in it because you just have a hard time seeing worth, self-worth or anything. And the idea that someone I respected and admired so much believed in me, helped me until I could believe in myself. He would see me no matter what shape I was in. If I showed up to a show, he would see me. It wasn't even the words, it was the action. The action said, you still have something to say. I still believe in you. And I'm going to make space for you and open the door for you because of this. And so I really looked at that. And I think that saved me from sinking deeper. And when I was ready to get well, that was the thing I was going back to. I was getting well to run back to words and writing and seeing David again. And I didn't realize he saved my life until I started to write that essay about him in grad school. One night it was like an epiphany and I realized, shit, I think he really saved my life. And then I wrote to him and told him that. I mean, I knew it inside, but I didn't say it out loud to myself until then.
I think that's what's so incredible about David is that he's made it big time, but he still passes the baton and he makes space for other people. We lack a lot of that in today's world.
Yes, he's so generous. People have no idea how generous he is, especially because his work shows sometimes a crabby, kind of self-deprecating, hilarious guy. You know, he's a very loyal and generous and unbelievably kind person.
I think it's incredible to be so kind and not forget what you went through before you did have that great success. And you're living your life now that you have this success the same way. And you find the love in your life from helping all your students. I'm sure you mean everything to them.
I started teaching again after Mother Noise came out, in part to have some structure in my life, to have some income. I had taught years ago for a group of homeschoolers, teenagers. And I was kind of like, oh, I guess I'll teach again. And once it started, I forgot how much I love teaching. And I love it because it's an honor to be a witness to other people's stories. It's an honor to help them be their best selves on paper. And what some of my students bring to class, the stuff they're writing about, the bravery, the courage. Sometimes I shut down my Zoom class and I just am overwhelmed with emotion. I feel privileged every single class that I have, my private students, everything. I feel so lucky to be that person for them that reads, that sees them, that encourages, you know, to tell someone, this is an amazing line, or this piece really made me tear up, or to be the person who's giving that back when I've had so much of that in my life is really amazing. I think I'll always try to teach, even if it's a little bit, you know, I'll always want to do it because it helps your own writing. It's just a circle of connection and sharing. And it's incredible.
It is incredible. And the connection is really the piece. And I've had my mentor, Jeff Lubin, on the show. And he'll say things to me that really surprise me and I don't even see in myself. Like one time he said, "Carrie, you're really resilient and with your resiliency, you help other people by showing them your resiliency." I'm like, "What?" And I don't see that. I just see a person who got a lot of things wrong and made a lot of mistakes, and I focus more on the mistakes. But people are always looking for someone to inspire them, whether they're lucky enough to have a mentor or lucky enough to listen to you on this episode. When you had to find something to hold on to, Tim O'Brien was someone that really inspired you. Can you talk about that?
His book, The Things They Carried, is just one of those books. It's always going to be on my top five list of favorite books. And at the time, I had been discharged from a long stay in a hospital for depression. I was, I think, in my early 20s, and I could not get out of bed. Like I wasn't okay. I probably shouldn't have been discharged from the hospital, and I got it in my head one day. I just was going to read everything I could about Vietnam. I think I just wanted to get out of my own head. And I ended up with his book, and it's just such a beautiful book. I think it just gave me a bigger perspective or took me out of my own mind, and to see the art on those pages and what he did with his own experience as a soldier in Vietnam. It's a beautiful book. Part of it, he talks about being a writer and he talks about Vietnam, but he has these things that he says in the book, like stories can save our lives. And it was sort of like a bolt of light coming out of nowhere and just bathing me in this reason for living when I so desperately needed a reason. And I still reread that book and I still think about it. I recommend that book to people. It's just a beautiful book. It's really a book of survival, how we make meaning in our lives. And it's gorgeous, gorgeous book.
I bet it's amazing. And a book can really save you. I had Natalie Liu on the show, and I really feel like she saved my life with her book. I couldn't figure it out, and she laid it out as a blueprint for me. She still means so much to me. And she lives in England, and I'm all the way here in Boston. How did I find her book? God sent me that book. I know that for a fact. So there's great healing that can happen from a book. And I love your book so much. I've read it three times. You're like, okay, Carrie, that's... Can't do it once, had to do it three times. But I don't think people are talking about how difficult it is to get divorced with a child and what that looks like. And you said that overcoming some of those difficult things was harder than beating heroin. And I thought that was probably the most powerful thing that you wrote.
I got clean 10 years before I had a child. And I sort of assumed that everything would be easy now. And what happened is I married someone who was just very, very closed off, and it wasn't a good relationship. We separated when my son was three. And then I thought it would be an okay divorce, but then my ex got involved, ended up marrying someone the day after our divorce was finalized, who was not well, in my opinion, and proceeded to be incredibly hard on my child and just completely in conflict with me constantly. It wasn't about my child. It was about her own, whatever her own stuff is, I believe. But having to send my child, and my ex didn't have overnights. They had very little visitation, but having to send my child with people that I knew were not looking out for him the way I was, and having to navigate how to legally make this safe for my child. My son had food allergies and they would feed him the things he was allergic to. I mean, I was terrified. I would spend visitation basically wringing my hands. Sometimes I would drive to their house and park a block away and wait 2 hours till I could get my son. It was some of the hardest years of my life. People think you just call your lawyer and everything's solved, but you know, family court does not work that way. Unless there is overt constant abuse, you really can't. And I already had 98% custody, so there was little I could do but just get through it. And by the time my son was like six, he was screaming and crying saying, "Don't make me go." So it was a wake up, like, geez, I mean, I just really thought everything, the hardest thing that I would ever go through would be addiction. But what is much harder is when you can't control the world for the person you love the most. I had to really dig deep, and I was a single mother. So I found sliding scale therapy for my son. I read books. I did everything I could to control what I could control for him. And it was just very, very difficult. And luckily, sometimes the universe just gives you what you need. I had a lawyer who had handled my divorce and who had his own small children. I had known his wife in a writing like group years ago. He gave me free legal work for like 8 years, just out of the goodness of his heart. This guy saved us. People make jokes about lawyers. He's one of the best people I've ever met in my life, and just cared so much about my son and kept us out of getting deeper into the fighting. Like, sort of at times he called my ex-husband. Like, he really helped me so much. I still talk to him. He just won the largest settlement in the history of Connecticut for someone who was injured at work. So he deserves every good thing. But, you know, the gift of that. And that was another thing I saw, was that, so I'm going through the worst thing in my life. I feel like prey. I feel like these people are really hurting my son. And then ta-da, here's free legal advice for 8 years. I mean, the gift of that. So even in my deepest, most harrowing moment, I had to remember Ryan is here. I don't know why he's doing this for us, but he's like an angel. That was a weird balance, but it kept me from really wallowing, because how lucky was I?
How great would it be to find the love of your life, the man of your dreams? Do you believe online dating would work if you had the right tools to be successful? Well, I have exciting news. I've created your Best Shot at Love Masterclass. I cannot wait to share with you what's worked for me in my life and for many of my clients that have helped over the years. If you enroll in this class, you have a winning mindset and believe in getting help before you start something new. If you're ready to see changes in your dating life and want to take action, check out my free webinar at shotatlove.co. If you decide you're going to choose another path, that you're worth it, and you're willing to enroll in the masterclass, you can also register at shotatlove.co. I designed this masterclass specifically for you to be successful. Please know that everything you're going to learn in these 9 modules and 6 coaching calls has been carefully curated for you, so you can gain the success you truly want. I will be there for you the whole time. In the meantime, I wish you all the success, and I can't wait to hear about your story of finding love. I'm Carrie Brett, and I will be your mentor and friend through this incredible journey. I give you a lot of credit, because I'm listening to you talk about this terrible time. And my mom, who's Irish Catholic, always says, God helps those who help themselves. And she would say that to me all the time when I was having my struggles. You were tested, but you were rewarded by this gift of this free counsel, because you stayed sober. That's what I believe. Most people couldn't, because you see that they relapse when there's a death or something that they just can't manage. And you really have a lot of strength.
When my son was born, I had been clean for years. And once he was born, it was like there was a new level of sobriety. Something new became cemented, because this tiny person, I was it for him. In fact, during COVID, I was terrified that something would happen to me and he would have to go live with his dad. He loves his dad, and they see each other once a month or something now. And it's okay. It's, his dad wasn't the problem. It was the stepmother. But the idea that if I wasn't here, what would happen to him? I guess what I'm saying is I don't want to take too much credit, because it wasn't even a choice. You know, my only choice was to be the best parent. And in a lot of ways, I think of that custody situation almost like a gift, because it made me a better mother. My son could not handle another parent screwing up. Like, I had to be not perfect. No one's perfect, but I had to really be there for him. I had to be present. I had to make good decisions. I had to be reading and understanding child psychology. I had to really be the best possible mother I could be. I took it really seriously, like, because he didn't have anybody else.
Well, it just shows how you become superhuman as a mother, really.
And it's not even rare. Women all the time are doing unbelievable stuff for their kids. I mean, so many mothers in my life, they blow my mind with how good they are. And it's not about perfection. It's just about figuring out the job, figuring out your kid, because there's no one way to do this job. It depends on the child that you have. But mothers are so inspiring. The mothers in my life, I don't know what I would do without them. We do what we have to do for our kids. If someone told me years before that happened, this is what you're going to have to do, and this is the fight you're going to have, I would have said, I really can't. Like, you don't know me. I can't do that. But I could do it because I had to, and I did.
Yeah, I think that's how we overcome really hard things. What choice do we have? We have to continue on. You found a safe haven with a song, Morton's Fork. Tell me about that.
That was a band that I heard on NPR late one night and then completely fell in love with, like we do with music sometimes. And they had this song called Morton's Fork. And Morton's Fork is a term that means basically to be between a rock and a hard place. So no good options. And the song was so beautiful. And I would listen to it a lot in the middle of this stuff we were going through. And I ended up writing about it. And that guy, Kyle Morton, who the band is called Typhoon, and he's the lead singer and the writer. And when I wrote to him and said, you know, I wrote this essay about you, it's going to be in my book coming out, and I just want to see if you're okay with it. He was so lovely, so gracious. And then it ended up being my son's first concert because they were playing in New York. And so I took my son, and this was, I don't know, a month before the book came out. And it was one of those nights, and we're masked because it was still 2022. I'm watching the band play this song, and I'm standing with my now, I think he was like 14, and it's his first concert. And I just thought, I don't know how I made it here, but and that song meant so much to me. And then to be standing there with my kid who's okay, you know, more than okay, he's thriving and he's 14 and he's taller than me. We're in Greenwich Village listening to this band. It was just one of those moments where it was almost like when you just feel like, oh, I survived, and just this pure joy for a moment.
It's interesting how songs can give you hope, just like an essay or a book. I held on to the song Proud Mary, like in moments of my life. Tina Turner was everything to me. She knew the struggle, and that's why she could write about it. I think that struggle is real, and it's what you said, stories can change the world.
I feel like that is what we are here for as humans, is to make meaning out of our lives and share that. And that's why the arts are so powerful. And every time someone wants to cut arts programs, or I feel like you don't actually understand why it's important. Even people who aren't artists latch on to books, movies, songs, and it gets us through. I think because making art and sharing it is about connection, and we need to connect. That's built into our DNA. And even when we're alone, we can connect or feel connected through a song because someone is telling our story in the music. I feel so honored most days to have my life's work be about writing, making art, and trying to be a witness for other people's art. I just can't imagine a better life. It just makes me so happy. And I think it's so valuable.
What saved you was making art or making things out of horrible things that happened to you. Why should people write more or try to create as a way to heal?
I think it's a way of processing trauma or struggles. It's a way of turning something horrific into something beautiful. And it's also a way of sharing it by showing it to other people. Here's a photograph of what feels like the worst day I had, or here is a song I wrote about the worst thing that ever happened to me. The lead singer from Typhoon had Lyme disease as a child that was not diagnosed straight away. He was horribly ill, like almost died. Most of what he writes is about that, is about suffering physically and not knowing what was wrong with him. He feels it stunted his growth. Like, it really changed his life. He became someone who made a life out of writing about that and singing about it. I just think it's part of our humanity to be making art about it and sharing it.
You can use the pain. It's not easy to do, but I can remember doing some of my very best work in photography in some of the most darkest days. I can tap into the love of what I do. I love photography. I somehow can block it off, or I somehow can channel that pain. Moving forward and like keeping busy and just keep doing your best is a way of survival, don't you think?
Yes. You know, I've had the conversation with David over the years where we say, what do other people do? Because there's many times where I'll be in the middle of something awful, and there's like a little me on my shoulder watching and going, oh, I can't wait to get home and write about this. And it saves me. And I know that David is the same way. Some of the recent work he's done in his newest book, Happy Go Lucky, after his father died, he wrote about his difficult relationship with his father, who was a very difficult man. And that work, the first time I heard it in the wings backstage when he was reading it, I was just crying backstage. It's amazing. When you stuff things down and you don't deal with them, it can turn into depression. And if you're making art about it, that is dealing with it. It's not stuffing it down. When I'm writing, I usually figure out something I didn't know before I started the essay or the book. It's completely therapeutic. It's really how I process things, I think.
Well, I think being a creative, you're on an island by yourself. You create alone. You write alone. You do a lot of things alone. And it can be lonely. And we've talked a lot about the importance of connection. And one of David's recent essays that he read, he wrote about unconventional mothers, which we both feel like we are. And he talked about, who are these moms wearing sweatshirts that say, I'm a cool mom? And then his joke was, no, you're not. I thought that was the funniest thing ever. You parent the best you can. You show up and you do the things your way. And I think a lot of your life, you were not able to be honest, or you couldn't really show who you really were. One of the stories in your book, you write about that you were this girl that folded sweaters. And I thought that was the best story. I wasn't sure why you made fun of it, because I love that story. But you talked to me about, everyone has this storyline that we tell at a cocktail party. And why should we not use that story?
I think a lot of times we tell a story about ourselves that is, you know, digestible, easy to tell. And we get in this rhythm where we just tell it the same way. But a lot of times in writing, if you're writing nonfiction, you have to ask yourself, is that really the story? Like, or is that just something I've been saying forever? It's almost like, you know, when you go to a family dinner and your mother tells the story for the 15th time and you think to yourself, I don't think it actually happened that way, but she's so used to, she's right in it. I think that we do that. And sometimes we alter the story slightly depending on the company. But to really dig in there and see what's actually there, I think is really important.
I was just thinking about the Kardashians when Kris Jenner tells this story of when she was a flight attendant back in the day. And it's so funny because they're like, not the flight attendant story again. But it just made me laugh because it's a way to connect. Because everyone has someone in their life who retells that same story. Sometimes it's the most obvious things that are the funniest that you just didn't even expect. It's all a way, how do you connect with someone? And so when you took on this challenging process of writing your book, what did you learn? What did you learn about yourself?
The thing that comes to mind immediately is in the final essay, I had this moment where I was trying to write a closing essay that would close the book, and it wasn't going well, and I was really having a hard time. And I remembered there was this time where my son was with his dad and his stepmother, and he couldn't swim. He was 5 or 6. He fell into a pool fully clothed on their watch. I don't know if it's because they didn't realize you have to watch kids around water. I don't know. they brought him home still screaming in the wet clothes. They didn't even try to like comfort him. And so he came into my house screaming. And for years, I could just start bawling, just picturing him under the water without me. And because I wasn't there, so I didn't have any visual story about this, but I would think it and I would picture him under the water, and it would make me so upset. And it went on and on. And then one day, as I was trying to close my book, and my son was 13 by then, I realized, when I thought back to the pool incident, I no longer, somewhere in the few years that had passed, I'd stopped thinking of him under the water. And whenever I went back, my mind created an image of him coming out, of him leaving the water and coming into the air. And I don't know when I altered that image, but somewhere along the way I did. And I realized we have healed. Like, that is a healing thing, that I no longer picture him underwater. And I now automatically, without even deciding or thinking, I've stopped thinking of him that way. It was a very specific, clear moment of looking at myself and the stories I tell myself and realizing I've adjusted that according to our level of recovery from those years. And I have rearranged my own memories to reflect the change. And I was really excited. I mean, I don't want to live with that memory of his face underwater. And to know that that's how, and I think about the idea of memories being altered over the years. We all do that. We all, at some point, there are childhood memories. They may not even be real. You may have manufactured them. Memory is such a tricky thing, but it was very hopeful to me and positive to realize that I had changed my memory of what happened to him, because he's so much better and we've really come out of that and he's not in danger anymore. And that was like a huge specific thing I learned.
Definitely. And I think those limiting beliefs and those storylines that we tell ourselves, and we tell ourselves lots of things like, no one will date me because I have a child, or no one, who's going to want me? I've had all these setbacks. So isn't everybody. And right. If we change the way we look at things and the way that we talk to ourselves, I mean, I think about your journey. It took you so long to finally publish this memoir. Did you ever imagine that you'd be opening for David? I mean, it's amazing.
I had seen other people open for him, so I kind of thought maybe he would ask. But at the time, I thought, he'll ask, and I'm not a funny writer, so I'll do it once and I'll bomb, and that'll be the end of it. But when he did ask, I didn't want to bomb. So I worked really hard at writing something that was different than my usual work and that would work for a Sedaris audience. I hoped, but I did not know that this would be where I'd land, that this would be the future waiting for me. I had desperately hoped and worked my way toward it with a little bit of hope that it could happen. But yeah, I'm definitely, the last year I've been in just grateful city, just feeling so lucky.
It's so inspiring to see, and I'm so excited. People don't realize life is never really perfect. When you hit these things, sometimes they're not always what you exactly thought. And so now you're in the process of taking time for yourself, and you're just focusing on, for the first time, living alone, raising your son, and working. By saying that is really empowering, to say, this is what I need right now. I think a lot of people are afraid to be honest with that.
I worked for so long with the hope of someday publishing a book. And so I had all these ideas on what that would look like, but I really didn't know. When I got closer to the publication date and I was about to go on tour with David, I realized my second marriage to my second husband, and he's a great guy, he's a wonderful person, I just couldn't do it. I could not get this career off the ground and stay married. I saw it as, maybe it's a flaw in me that I don't know how to do this. All I knew was that I waited 30 years and I've got to make this work, and I have room to parent and I have room to get to work a lot. And so that was a really hard thing. I never imagined that I would publish my book and separate from my husband. He moved down the street. And I'm really happy. I'm really, even though I feel sad and I feel like, you know, it's a second failed marriage, I just cannot do it right now. And so I feel like if I had not worked 100% as hard as I needed to, and I lost things career-wise. I just couldn't live with it. I just couldn't. And my son is always first, so that's a given. I'm not sure that this is exactly how I thought this would look, but at the same time, it's fine. You know, I feel pretty happy. I like working. I like teaching. And my son and I have always been a great team.
You can find love in other places rather than being in a relationship.
Yes. I'm a relationship person my whole life. I had relationships, but now I'm finding that the connection, I feel like my classroom, even on Zoom with these amazing people, is almost like a holy place for me. And the connection I get from hearing these very intimate stories, it's memoir writing. So people are writing about the hardest things in their lives. And to be a witness to that and to just have the honor of listening to that and reading people's lives feels like enough connection right now. I find it incredibly meaningful watching people grow and seeing the relationships that form in the class. And this is on Zoom. So I didn't even think this was possible, but it's amazing. I have a couple of private students that I feel close to. And it's just, it's a different way of connecting to people. And I rarely leave my house. So I still feel very connected somehow. I don't go out much.
That's so funny. Well, it's amazing, really, the power of connection. And I don't think people talk about it that much, but it is something to really hold on to when you're having a hard time or you're writing or you need some help. And I think people don't realize how much of a lack of connection they're experiencing sometimes. And I think it's important to shine a light on that for sure. I love that you said you don't really leave your house. That's so funny to me. So I just feel so lucky that we were able to connect and you were able to share your story and you were able to come here and share with others how you've survived some really hard times and share your advice. What's in store for your future?
I'm working on my second book, which is really hard. It's just as hard to write the second one as the first one. Who knew? Yeah. And I am teaching through Gotham Writers Workshop. And I also teach at the Lesley University MFA program, which is great. And that's where I went for my MFA. So I get to work beside the professors who were so important to me. And I'm still opening for David. I'm doing 5 shows this fall and I'll do some next spring. And that's about it.
That's amazing. That's so great. So where can they find your book or find you on social media?
My book is pretty much in most bookstores. It's on Amazon. They can find my author page through Simon & Schuster. I'm on Instagram, Twitter, all the evil social media. I'm not very active. I go through stages.
Well, I want to start a press tour for you because I'm your biggest fan. But thanks so much for your time today, Cindy. You're great.
Thank you, Carrie. It's really nice to be here. Thank you so much.
And for now, this week, Shot at Love dating tips that are inspired by our guest, writer Cindy House. Number 1, if you want to make a real connection, lose the story you're used to telling about your life at a cocktail party and try out a different story. Number 2, the storylines we tell ourselves about our life situation oftentimes isn't true. It's time to stop playing small and holding ourselves back. Number 3, find connection or hope with a new friend, a book, or a song. Life is challenging, and we need something that inspires us or to hold on to. I hope you found some of my tips helpful this week. This is what Shot at Love is here for, to help you find love. Keep up the commitment to yourself and commit to helping someone else by sharing this podcast. Stay tuned for more episodes, and if you like this show, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. I'm Carrie Brett, and we'll see you next time.